Why are things the way they are? Okay, that's a ridiculous question. Nevertheless, it's probably the main question that got me into learning about history. What events lead up to now? How did our society and planet get to where it is today, from the past? This is, of course, impossible to answer, at least in full. How could we ever comprehend trillions of individual human decisions adding up to our current reality? And yet, that's what happened. It's easy to feel overwhelmed trying to grasp this, but that's why we study history. We'll never know it all, but we can study what we do know and try our best to make educated guesses. That's the whole pursuit in a nutshell. Trying to thread some kind of progression, or even a narrative, onto millennia of human chaos. But once in a while, though not very often, historians catch a break, and it becomes easy to pinpoint a moment or an era where everything changed, where you can see cause and effect with perfect clarity, a bold line from then to now. And probably the quintessential example of one of those moments was the Industrial Revolution. All right, you probably already know I'm gonna say it. It was less of a moment than a long and complex transformation. But even so, this is one of, if not the number one turning point in human history, when the modern world we live in today truly began. I think most of us have at least a cursory idea of what the Industrial Revolution was, but just in case, I'm talking about the era when, beginning in the 1780s, Great Britain, and then the United States and the rest of Europe, well, industrialized. You can probably picture the greatest hits of what that means already. Cheap labor crowded into polluted cities, a glut of factories and exploitation, but also innovations like the steam engine and steam power, mass production, machine tools, the assembly line, ironworking, and chemistry. But those are really just all the details, and what everybody basically knows already. What makes the Industrial Revolution so amazing and mind-boggling to me is how profoundly humanity's daily lives changed. All the ways our societies and family units operate, from our homes and what's in them to how we make a living, the ways we solve problems and regard each other, especially the way we eat and what we eat. By the time this was all over, I'm using air quotes since the Industrial Revolution still continues today, almost nothing about humans' lives would be left unchanged, no matter the status or the social class. This is probably the best way to drive the point home. Just pause and imagine the difference between your life now and the life of someone in the early 1700s. I rest my case. Just kidding, I'm gonna go on for like another hour or so. It's worth pondering the bigger picture here too. The raw power that industrializing and becoming a technological, capitalist world society granted us. A power over nature and this planet that was completely unprecedented, and which we might not have been exactly ready for. We now have the power to destroy ourselves in any number of human-manufactured ways. That's a big part of what makes this the beginning of the modern world. And depending on how you look at it, the Industrial Revolution is either humanity's greatest triumph and rise to ascension, or its greatest folly, the main road marker on the way to our doom and disaster. Really, from day to day and mood to mood, I fluctuate between these two positions. Will we modern humans use all this technological power to transcend ourselves or destroy ourselves? Which way will we ultimately go? These are grand scientific and philosophical questions, far above the pay grade of this podcaster, chef, and history fan. But perhaps we'll find some clues if we study the more tangible things we can see changed in people's everyday lives, particularly the impact on food and cuisine. Of course, we'll see that food itself and the access to it and amount of it was the main driver of all this happening in the first place. You see, in the several centuries leading up to the 1780s, when industrialization really kicked off, massive changes were already reshaping the world of farming in Western Europe. Historians use the term agricultural revolution to describe when Europeans, the British in particular, willed a massive productivity increase out of their farmlands, dramatically increasing their food supply and causing a population explosion as a result. We actually call this the Second Agricultural Revolution, because it's the only historical event since the first one, the Neolithic 10,000 years ago, that is even comparable. Way back when, pre-civilization, when people gradually were giving up foraging to settle onto farms, they too greatly increased their population and thus changed everything about humans' daily lives. But in the thousands of years since the Neolithic Revolution, not too much had actually changed in how people lived. Despite the myriad different cultures and governments and civilizations across the ages, the average day and challenges for a subsistence farmer in particular actually looked pretty darn similar in a lot of ways. From medieval or Dark Ages Europe, or even ancient Rome, to say, ancient Egypt, study primary sources and descriptions of life across the spectrum, and you'll find a striking amount of commonalities. What I'm saying is that the first agricultural revolution reshaped the human world and created a brand new paradigm that largely held in place for millennia afterwards, until the Industrial Revolution changed it all again, making these two major events in farming the two greatest turning points in the history of Homo sapiens. Nothing else even comes close. So, after that overly hyped up introduction, here's some of the ways that the Second Agricultural Revolution, predating industrialization, happened. Actually, two really quick things first. Note, as we talk through this, how modest and unassuming all these changes will seem by themselves out of context. But remember what they all add up to. And secondly, keep in mind that not all of these innovations were necessarily new or even invented by the British. Many were Chinese or from other distant places, inventions that had been around for centuries, but had only recently made their way to Europe. The British applied them all together in one time and space on such a massive scale that their entire society was altered. Maybe the most important innovation, and you'll see what I mean by being modest here, was in simply choosing which crops to plant and how. Specifically, the introduction of clover and turnips. Yes, turnips, which everyone knows are the source of all industrialization. These new-to-the-area crops were introduced into the traditional crop rotation system, which had predominated since the Middle Ages. It turned the three-field system into the four-field system, in which no land had to be left fallow and thus wasted, and the choice of crops and the order in which they were rotated around the fields could replenish nutrients and keep the soil more healthy and productive. Turnips could grow over the winter, keep weeds down, and could still be foraged by their animals like the old fallow fields. A successive planting of clover would add nitrogen back into the soil and also made excellent pasture for animals, so much so that a lot more animals could be kept and fed over the winter, which meant more milk, cheese, and meat for overall consumption, which of course did wonders for people's nutrition. All sorts of newly adopted technologies contribute to the rise in the food supply, too. chemical fertilizers and pesticides, threshing machines, combines, the seed drill, and the new Dutch plow, which we mentioned briefly last episode. The Dutch plow had an iron tip, and its design allowed it to be pulled by just two or three oxen, as opposed to six or eight, a huge upgrade in plowing efficiency. The Brits adapted this technology to their boggy soils, and then improved its design as well, allowing for the clearing and shaping of more farmland faster than ever before. One less obvious contributor to this agricultural revolution, because it had been happening steadily since the 12th century, was the enclosure phenomenon, in which more and more farmland was fenced in and enclosed. More common in the Middle Ages was the open field system, where villages and manors often had communal farm fields whose produce was shared, especially when it came to open areas for grazing animals. Private land ownership was rare for a lot of human history. But changes beginning with the Black Death meant that more and more people were being pushed off of their land, which had been deemed backwards and inefficient, in favor of farmland that was being organized into larger, more efficient, business-like estates, whose owners fenced and enclosed fields into private property. These agricultural estates almost ran like factories, or at least an early version of them, and they could be run much faster in terms of division of labor and specialized tasks. No longer was one farmer responsible for every aspect of preparing, growing, tending, harvesting, processing, and selling the food. Instead, hired labor performed all these tasks as owners maximized in favor of doing more with less labor. This was the age of capitalism in full force, a new way of running the economy, and you really see it first on farms. Now more of a business as opposed to a way of life. The process of privatizing and consolidating land accelerated in the centuries leading up to the Industrial Revolution, paving the way for a reshaping of society that was to come. Soon, communal fields had all but disappeared in favor of big farms. There would be some big consequences from these super productive mega farms taking over everything. But before we get ahead of ourselves, first, the main sum of all these disparate, seemingly not that big of a deal advancements on their own was that there would soon be a lot more food around, and then a lot more people to eat it. Now, I've said that many times before on this podcast. It's pretty much the story of every civilization starting out. But remember that the Industrial Revolution is so much bigger than everything that came before. It's that same old principle of food begetting population, begetting societal change, but at such an explosive level that nothing would ever be the same. That's the agricultural revolution at work. It's truly astounding to me, even when it comes to events as recent as this. Food and changes to the way people acquire it and eat it are the main driver of history. Despite all this rapid change and the forthcoming industrialization of Britain, Europe, and the United States, and soon the world, farming and agricultural food production remained a central part of most people's lives for a long time, although the proportion of the workforce engaged in agriculture declined steadily throughout and beyond the Industrial Revolution, agriculture still remained the single largest employer of people well into the second half of the 1800s. But the late 18th century in Great Britain was the turning point when things started moving the other way, in the direction of the reality we live in now, with more people living and working in cities than are farming the countryside. This is how that happened. All this newly styled farmland was both much more productive and needed less people to work it more efficiently. After the population boom to end all population booms, with the overall amount of people doubling and then tripling and just still going up after just a few decades, You have all these people born, and suddenly the old ways of life are no longer around to accommodate them. They can't just rent some land, grow some crops, and raise some animals and live day to day like their subsistence farming forefathers. There is no land left not occupied by Big Ag, and jobs to work those farms are scarce. So you get this sudden arrival of a new class of jobless poor, growing all the time as all the food generated by these job-killing farms continued the population boom. The only choice for these destitute ex-farmers was to move into one of the growing cities. Actually, another choice was to try their luck in the American colonies, but we learned last episode about how well that was going at the time. So most people's only real choice was to move to the city and try to get a job at one of the growing number of factories emerging. And with so many people around, the cost of labor was way down. People had to settle for the worst possible wages, and had little hope of ever owning their own property or business. I'm basically paraphrasing food historian Ken Albella here, who also points out that this moment is the creation of the proletariat, a working class that's very distinct from peasants of past ages. We'll see why in a bit, but the point is that British entrepreneurs and businessmen were ready with cash and new technology in hand to exploit this abundance of workers. They had also realized how much money they could make if the old practices of state protectionist mercantilism were cast off, and if their economy lived in Adam Smith's dream of an unrestricted, totally free trade market. So that's exactly what they made happen. Manufacturers used steam power and dirt-cheap labor to mass-produce cheaper goods at huge scales, with the goal to sell both domestically, but more so export abroad to a huge market. This was both the beginning of mass production and of the consumer-based society we live in today, where people no longer generally made the things they need. Instead, manufacturers figured out what people need and sell it to them, or in many cases, convince people they need something and sell to a need that wasn't really there before. Yes, this is also the birth of modern advertising as well. From now on, the average items found in people's homes were not of the household. Instead of crafting their own needs in-house, as had been done since the dawn of civilization, people increasingly bought their items from a store. Soon, more and more people had the same stuff, which had been standardized to be mass-produced and then mass-marketed. And besides maybe textiles and clothing, by far the biggest changes that came about from this shift were for food. More and more pantry staples, and even whole meals processed from start to finish, were not cooked in the home or even bought from local neighborhood artisan chefs and bakers. They were manufactured and sold. So what happens as a result? Ken Albella again describes how traditions for how to prepare many foodstuffs disappear from cookbooks and people's lives at the same time. His great example is ketchup or mustard, and how rare it is to find someone making their own today. It's something that we've all decided, or been convinced, is something we should buy from the store instead, and we almost all prefer and buy the same brand. This trend of both middle-class entrepreneurs and working-class people no longer making much of their own stuff is still continuing today. The connection between producer, process, and customer gets murkier and more distant all the time, as more and more cooking knowledge and knowledge in general becomes obscure and in some cases lost to a few specialists manufactured somewhere else. For this reason, it's hard not to think of the agricultural, industrial, and capitalist revolution as dehumanizing. Everything that's wrong with how we eat today, all the processed foods and excess sugar and lack of general cooking knowledge, can all be traced back to the changes begun in the Industrial Revolution. Maybe I'm being a bit of a downer because it's not all bad. Like all history, the qualitative effect of the Industrial Revolution is complicated. The often hopeless, destitute, working poor would not have tolerated these conditions if it wasn't the best of several bad options for them, and I want to explore why. I think the best way to do that is to examine people's food and people's diets, before and after. I think we can spend most of the rest of this episode just dissecting how people ate during more than two centuries of industrialization. Now, that's a long period of time to speak generally about, so forgive me please if I jump around and stretch time a little bit trying to describe the trends and narrative of what was going on. Rather than break apart this era into its appropriate sub-eras, which were quite different from each other, I'm trying to paint the broad strokes and draw a through line with food through the whole thing. I won't sugarcoat it, despite all the piles of sugar people were stuffing into their faces. Researching this episode was a little bit depressing for me, from both a historical and a culinary perspective. The modernization and industrialization of food, while coming with some major advantages, has had a net negative on human taste buds, and probably nutrition too. It's the story of how factory food takes over the world. But is that just my biased modern chef's opinion coming from my cushy, fully industrialized position in the future? Maybe I'm ignorant. Maybe people were better off. So to find out which way is correct, let's talk standard of living. Forget taste and quality for just a moment if you can. I know it's hard. And think about eating from a pure calories and nutrition standpoint. Were working class people living in cities better off or worse off than the agricultural peasants they had descended from? Because the historical narrative seems to be that they were pretty miserable. When in fact the reality is, there are many reasons that such a question is more complicated and difficult to answer. Even though the Industrial Revolution was not that long ago relatively, we still face all the same problems that we face trying to learn about daily life in any time in the past, whether we're talking about 10,000 BCE or the 1780s AD. Things like the measurement of people's wages, the national GDP, calorie availability are all difficult to discern in the present. As for pre- and modern Britain, the vast amounts of data required to analyze those topics was simply not collected back then. So many researchers apply what we know about the present onto the people of the past and make extrapolations. We've talked before about how this is a surefire recipe to cook up some inaccurate cognitive biases, and a dangerous way overall to try and understand history. It's the reason that historians can disagree with each other and debate these things from opposite ends of the spectrum, and why you can make a case and find sources to support both assertions, that people had terrible lives, or that they had it pretty good, compared to people in the past. The majority of historians seem to take the more pessimistic approach, arguing that the urban working class had to endure a century and a half of hard toil with little or no advancing economically before their descendants saw any benefit from the transformations they'd helped create by working in factories. You can make a pretty good argument that life was awful for industrial workers, but here's the key thing. When you compare it to agricultural peasants of the past, the picture doesn't look as bad. Let's see if we can answer this. What proportion of their income were working families forced to spend on food? This is a good marker of overall health because in general, now and in the past as well, poor families spend the greater portion of their income on the cheapest, most energy-rich foods. And as income rises, less proportion of wages are spent on food. Makes sense, right? If you have more money, less of it is going to the bare necessities and more to extra things. Seeing how much of people's hard work went to just putting food on the table should give us a crude indication of the economic well-being of industrial families. For a point of comparison, let's start with subsistence farmers who didn't industrialize, for whom the situation is pretty grim. On average, poor farming families spent as much as 75% of their income on food, and nearly two-thirds of that was just on making bread. Not buying bread, mind you, but just producing loaves made by hand cost them all of that income. You really see why they call it subsistence farming. Almost all the work these people did was just going to getting enough to eat every day. This picture for the rural poor didn't change much through most of history, let alone the period of industrialization into the 1850s. But for those who moved into the city and participated in industrialization, the still impoverished, yes, industrial workers and miners over the same period, it's closer to just half of their incomes on food, and even less of it on actual bread, which was much cheaper in its mass-produced urban forms. You know, not a great situation, but still an improvement over the rural alternative. There's a clear difference between the cost of people's diets in the agricultural and industrial sectors. And it's the same when you compare the actual contents on people's plates. Again, for farmers spending almost all their capital on bread, there wasn't much left over for other items beyond the occasional scraps of milk, butter, cheese, tea, and sugar. As it was across history, meat consumption was very rare. But industrial families tended to have more money to spend on a more varied diet, especially more animal protein. You know how most people today eat meat every day or even every meal without a second thought? Well, this is the very beginning of that. And while industrial workers still didn't eat that much, they had considerably more of it than their rural counterparts did. And they had put their foot in the world that we live in today, where meat is not only no longer a luxury food, but simply standard fare. Urban families also spent considerably more on things like potatoes, cheese, butter, milk, and even imported items. Coffee had become a regular expenditure for workers, who had to wake up quite early for the factory whistle. And from my amateur reading of all the material, it seems like there was just more flavor to go around in urban areas. Just like today, salt, pepper, mustard, vinegar, malt, rice, currants, and raisins. Eggs were routinely purchased. Despite being only a little bit better off than their rural counterparts, the slightly higher incomes of industrial families enabled them to produce a more substantial and varied diet than those living off the land. Industrial families also didn't seem to have to worry about famine and economic shocks as much, which so drove hunger in the agricultural sector. The agricultural revolution had taken care of that, so productive that even with all the millions of extra people around, food shortages nearly became a thing of the past. From this point on, if famines happened in industrial societies, it was a result of either human incompetence or malice, or both, if you look at cases like the Irish potato famine and the Great Famine in India. Industrial cities are often depicted as destitute places where masses of poor people struggle to find jobs. And this was true to an extent, but the precarious employment situation did not seem to be enough to ever plunge families into the cycle of famine and hunger that so plagued rural areas across history. There was still general malnutrition and hunger, of course. There still are today. But full-on starvation seems to have been eliminated in cities. In times of hardship, families simply scaled back their purchases of those extra food items we noted before, and reverted to the more bread-based diet that was already normal in the countryside. Listen to how one primary source describes it. Thomas Burt was the first working-class member of Parliament. His father was a miner in the northeast of England, and although growing up the family had had its share of hard times, young Thomas noted that the consequence was a more limited diet, not hunger. Quote, "The butter was sometimes short, and cheese, alas, was not more plentiful. Nonetheless, we were fortunate enough to never lack bread." Higher wages and the fact that households typically comprise several adolescent and child workers in addition to the male breadwinner also helped to carry families through the hard times. Again, people weren't just monsters. There's a reason they felt they had no choice but to send their young children to labor in factories. It guaranteed safety to the whole family unit. I don't want to paint too warm a picture. I'm not trying to say that these people were eating well or had good nutrition. No, I wouldn't say that at all. It was just an improvement over the rural peasant life that had so dominated Europe for thousands of years. I'm not trying to both sides this and say, actually, the Industrial Revolution was great for the poor working class. It was, in fact, a pretty miserable cocktail of poverty, malnutrition, and poor health from pollution and industrial side effects. But my point is, yes, it might have still been a step up for a lot of people. But now, let's get into the bad of it. This is the time when you see rising sugar consumption amongst the masses go from a net benefit to a dangerous excess. A huge sugar refining industry right in London resulted in an advertising blitz convincing people to buy sweets and sugar to put in their tea. Sweet tea became one of the main staples in workers' diets. Way too much of the stuff, in fact, leading to all sorts of health problems, especially those famous British teeth. Yes, it was more varied than a farmer's diet, but the staple foods of the industrial worker were rarely more than those bread, potatoes, dairy, bacon, and tea. Again, not great. Outbreaks of scurvy were common, since no one was eating many veggies or getting much vitamin C. You also see widespread rickets from lack of sunlight and vitamin D. You know, due to kids and everybody else working indoors for 16 plus hours a day. Remember too that this is the capitalist era of no regulation whatsoever. Cities became polluted places filled with smoggy air and industrial waste, filling every nook and cranny. Not exactly good for the general health and well-being. More chemicals and foreign substances found their way into food, and not just by accident. Manufacturers filled out cocoa powder with brick dust, used copper to make pickles greener, lead to make bright candies, and so on. In a mass race for bread manufacturers to produce the most perfect, purest, and whitest bread, literal chalk was added until they discovered bleaching flour. This was all kind of a dirty trick played against people because until this point, whiter bread had always indicated higher quality in the era of hand or animal or even water-powered milling. But the industrial rollers, which now ground flour into fine white dust, as well as the use of commercial yeasts, chemical leaveners, and commercial ovens, actually killed many of the natural nutrients and other good things about eating bread in the first place. Poor farmers may have had worse, less varied diets than urban workers, but I guarantee you, they ate better bread. People did complain about all this crap in their food, and about the industrialization of processed food at the time. But manufacturers had the capital and the resources to endure and win lengthy court battles. With no official food regulation until the 1860s, there was little change for a long time. Just look to how factory owners often provided many of the daily meals for their workers, especially when it came to children. Because if you're going to shamelessly exploit impoverished child labor, at least have the decency to feed the little blokes. but mealtime in the factory was usually a bleak, if not outright dangerous, situation. In most textile mills, children had to eat their meals while still working, risking injury in the machinery and getting all sorts of dust and contaminants from factory work on their hands and into their food while eating. One middle-class cloth merchant named Abraham Whitehead was disgusted by what he saw and joined a campaign for factory legislation. He told a parliamentary committee in 1832, half a century after this had already been going on, that the youngest age at which children are employed is never under 5, but some are employed between 5 and 6, in woolen mills, as piecers. I have frequently seen them going to work between 5 and 6 in the morning. They get their breakfast as they eat and work. There is generally a pot of water porridge with a little treacle in it placed at the end of the machine. Sarah Carpenter was one of those child workers at Crestbrook Mill and described her daily meals as such. Our common food was oatcake. It was thick and coarse. This oat cake was put into cans. Boiled milk and water was poured into it. This was our breakfast and supper. Our dinner was potato pie with boiled bacon in it, a bit here and a bit there, so thick with fat we could scarcely eat it, though we were hungry enough to eat anything. We were only allowed 3 meals a day, though we got up at 5 in the morning and worked till 9 at night. So I'll reiterate that the industrial proletariat didn't exactly have it good. They ate bare-bones diets and had almost no social mobility for over a century. But it was better than the life of a rural peasant, and in that way represents a step up. And there's a case to be made that this was the slow beginning of the improvement of everyone's general welfare going into the modern era. Though there's plenty case to be made also that we have a long, long way to go, if we ever get there at all. This brings up another point I've been wanting to mention. Despite the rise of factory food during the Industrial Revolution, not everyone just opened their mouths and swallowed this new processed reality. There were many who spoke out, who rebelled, counter-revolutions against a rapidly changing world. You get movements of people who saw industrial society as both unhealthy and morally corrupt. Probably their most famous advocate is the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau is best known for writing about how humans, in their natural state, in the wild, are basically good, and that all evil and corruption and misery comes from unnatural things that we do to each other, like slavery, violence, subjugation, and the domination of nature. From urban civilization, in other words. Rousseau sort of inspired the whole 19th century movement called Romanticism. He died just as the real industrialization was getting going, but had already witnessed many of the changes brought on from agriculture, and did not like what he saw. As part of this worldview, Rousseau was particularly critical of people's diets, and of his homeland of France especially. He denounced French cuisine because it was the most complex and sophisticated world cuisine at that time, probably outside of China. He argued that we would all be better off if we focused on eating what he saw as a simple farmer's diet, foraged produce and simple breads and cheeses. As we noted before, the facts don't necessarily support this argument, but in principle, it does seem to make sense. Rousseau also argued that people should not eat meat unless they were prepared to kill it themselves, with their bare hands, and no other tools of any kind. Brutal, but honest. I understand the point he was trying to make of our hypocrisy that has only gotten monumentally worse in the era of factory farming. How we disconnect ourselves from the process of getting our meat. We have farmers and factories and processors and butchers in between us and the animals being caged and slaughtered for our own consumption. I don't think Jean-Jacques would be so happy if he saw how society progressed today. Rousseau was making a moral argument, but many other intellectuals and so-called health experts believed meat was unhealthy from a nutrition standpoint, and made somewhat scientific arguments advocating for all vegetable diets. With the scientific revolution having by now fully disproved the humoral system of Galen, which all doctors and health experts had agreed on for centuries, everything was suddenly up in the air, and there was all sorts of competing theories and ideas, many often contradicting each other about what sorts of diets people should eat. Some was scientific, some was quackery, no one really knew what was going on with diets and the human body. In other words, it was really no different than it is today. The Romantics and these early health gurus and the first Western vegetarians are the clear ancestors to the modern health food movement. They all saw industrial society as a mistake. These ideas would grow in popularity over the century, and of course, eventually go mainstream and be co-opted by the food industry itself. But that's a story for another podcast. Before we wrap up, I just want to mention a couple other important, or at least interesting, ways that eating changed during the Industrial Revolution. For one, this is essentially the invention of lunch and dinner as we know them today. We've seen before how the structure of mealtimes was very different in the past, and while every society did things their own way, the current three-meal breakfast, lunch, and dinner structure we're all so familiar with now was pretty much unheard of. A very common setup across pre-modern societies did seem to be having the largest meal of the day in the early afternoon, and lighter meals, if anything, in the earlier and later time slots. Work schedules in the industrial era prevented factory workers from coming home to this traditional meal, so this dinner type of affair was pushed later and later into the day, either into the evening like most of us have it today, or in some cases very late indeed, maybe at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. But workers on the job still needed calories midday, so a new sort of meal was taking shape. We'll call it lunch, which until this time had generally just referred to more of a snack, really. Lunch, while rising in importance, continued to follow this model and was rarely anything fancy or close to it. Almost always eaten cold, it might be leftover pie, or even not more than a crust of bread. Maybe a piece of cheese or butter to go with it, but probably not every day. Workers usually brought this lunch with them from home, often in a tin pail, or they bought it near their place of work. This new midday workers' meal was casual from the very beginning. Food historian Abigail Carroll points out how lunch didn't have to do the cultural work that dinner does. There was no pressure to eat it with other people and bond with others, and you could eat it alone, often, as we pointed out, while continuing to work. Lunch rooms didn't come along until government regulators got involved deep into the 19th century. So far, we've mentioned a lot of farming and manufacturing innovations that drove the Industrial Revolution, and the ways eating changed as a result. But what about actual food and cooking technology? One of the most life-changing was the invention of canning. People had, of course, been preserving their food for millennia through other ancient techniques like salting, curing, smoking, or drying. But like all things Industrial Revolution, canning was a total game changer. Its origins coincide with the beginnings of industrialization, when a French chef and confectioner named Nicolas Appert began experimenting with preserving all kinds of food in jars in the late 1700s. His goal was to do everything he could to remove air, which he believed to be the source of all food spoilage. It was actually a pretty popular and seemingly common sense theory at the time, but it wasn't quite right. food spoilage is caused by microbes, which no one knew existed until Louis Pasteur proved it 50 years later. Before that, though, one Napoleon Bonaparte had taken over the French state and was amassing his famously huge for the time armies. He needed a way to feed all those troops, and so offered a prize of 12,000 francs to any inventor who could figure out a way to feed millions of soldiers in the field. This prize seemed to motivate Nick Appert to continue his earlier experiments. He may have not been correct in his science, but he was obviously onto something with his method, which was sealing glass containers with wax and then boiling them. Appert perfected the method and won the contest. Canning, although really just glass jarring at this point, was born. But the game, of course, really changed later when industrial Britain took this concept on and changed it to suit their purposes. They replaced the highly fragile glass jars with nearly unbreakable tin. The tin can had arrived. As both a chef and an amateur historian, I have very mixed feelings about canning. As a novel and effective way to preserve all kinds of food, canning is a marvel of technology. Cans can last for decades, providing food security which had never been seen on the planet Earth until this point. This was unquestionably a benefit to people's lives. But the chef side of me, of course, mourns the loss of freshness and flavor that comes from the canning process. I can appreciate the usefulness, especially in times of surplus with no other way to save all the extra produce. But the birth of canning is also the beginning of processed, prepared, and boxed food, which would rise in the years to come. It's food security and convenience in substitution of taste, which, again, I totally get, but I can still cry about from my position of privilege today. And it is a position of privilege. I'm not talking about my white privilege, which is very real, just a different subject. I'm talking about the privilege all people in the world have today as a result of our pretty recent ancestors suffering through the Industrial Revolution. You can romanticize the past. You can convince yourselves things were somehow better by virtue of some mythical simplicity or lost values. But the fact is, global poverty, while still a significant problem, has been drastically reduced by industrialism and, yes, capitalism. Has it been reduced equally or fairly? No. But even in those places and the people left behind in the capitalist race to the top, might have benefited from modern technology or medicine. It's not the system itself that's unjust, it's how it's been applied. So it's really hard to make an argument that all of our individual lives aren't better off today than they were before industrialization. You can, however, make a really good argument that it still won't have been worth the cost. That we may have improved all our lives, but by gaining the ability to destroy ourselves in the process, we will do so. It's possible this process may have already begun way back in the Neolithic and the first agricultural revolution, the first time that we sort of broke the game and changed human lives forever. Even today, after 12,000 or so years, it's still impossible to tell if this was a good decision or not. It's certainly not the life that millions and millions, actually billions of years of evolution, intends for us to live. But maybe we can make it work. It's really a difference of looking at history and current events from a narrow focus on our daily lives versus a bigger picture, a longer timeline. And really, just like historians trying to understand the past, we have to find a way to balance both. We're gonna have to use the benefits of science and technology at this point to survive, but not overindulge them. We can also improve the bigger picture by focusing in on improving people's daily lives and on incremental progress. It's not one extreme or the other. Elements of both sides will have to be sacrificed to ensure the survival of our species. But are we capable? Remember how I defined us in the very first episode of this podcast, and which I have left as the tagline of the show to this day? What makes a human? A human is just an animal who knows how to cook. And the Industrial Revolution is probably the craziest thing these animals have cooked up yet. Side note, the internet might prove to be a contender as well, but you could also argue that's simply a side effect of industrializing centuries prior. So, are we just big thinking animals who are out of our depth? Or have we cooked enough ingenious recipes over the ages to learn enough to transcend our primitive natures? That, my friends, is one broad, complicated question too far. And I don't think anyone yet knows the answer. That's enough rambling for one day, and for one season, too. So, this is it for now, folks. This is as far down the timeline as I go. Don't worry, the History of Food podcast will continue, but I'm stopping the chronology and the series thus far here, as this last episode brings us wholly into the modern era of food and history. It's not that there isn't value in studying the modern history of food. That's where most of the material is out there. It's a ton of fun learning the origins of dishes and foodstuffs we still eat today, or things like the first Western restaurants. It's not like food ever stops defining us or our histories. But modern history is just not as much in my armchair level of expertise as the ancient past is. And on top of that, there are numerous other resources out there already, and other podcasts too, that have already covered this stuff better than I could. Most food history out there tends to focus on the era we just entered, and I think it makes the most sense for this podcast to return to its roots and revisit the ancient world. So bear with me for what will, realistically, probably be a few months as I reorient myself and research and plan new content for the return of the history of food. I have a broad idea of what I want to do, but I need to re-listen to the whole show thus far to recall what I've covered and what I haven't, and probably read a couple books on the way as well. It's going to be a fun, freer, less chronology-bound show that will explore all kinds of subjects related to food and people's daily lives across history. I'll keep you all updated about what's going on social media, probably posting some recipes and food history-related articles as usual in the meantime. But until the podcast returns, this has been the third season of The History of Food. I'm the Anthrochef, saying bye for now. See you all after the hiatus.